Are you out of network in Broward County? Are city officials out of line in Key West? And is President Trump out to send the U.S. military into Venezuela? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll examine the standoff between Broward County's major hospital systems, Memorial Healthcare and Broward Health, and its largest healthcare insurer, Florida Blue, which has stranded some 50,000 patients. We'll also look at more Conch Republic controversy after Key West Planning Director resigned this week, adding to the ugly city hall optics there. And we'll discuss this week's U.S. military strike on a Venezuelan drug boat and what it portends. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bemvindo. Broward County's two-pronged public health system, Memorial Healthcare in the south, Broward Health in the north, constitutes one of the largest in the country, which means it handles one of the country's largest patient loads, or it did until this summer, when a dispute with Broward County's largest health insurer, Florida Blue, took the system out of network for some 50,000 patients. Broward Health broke with Florida Blue on July 1st. Memorial Healthcare followed suit this week on September 1st. The feud is one that's increasingly common in America's expensive and convoluted healthcare and health insurance order. The hospitals say they need higher reimbursements from insurers to cover their ever-rising costs. The insurers say raising those reimbursements will make policy premiums unaffordable for most patients. Meanwhile, Memorial Healthcare, Broward Health, and Florida Blue are still negotiating. Are you a Florida Blue policyholder who's suddenly frozen out of Broward County's major healthcare system? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Dr. Evan Boyar, Chief Medical Officer for Broward Health. A little later, we'll also talk with David Wagner, who is Florida Blue's South Florida Market President. Dr. Boyar, thank you for speaking with us.
Good afternoon.
I just want to start by asking if there is any news on the negotiation front. Are we any closer to a resolution that could put Broward Health and Memorial Healthcare back in network for Florida Blue policyholders?
I could speak for Broward Health alone, and the answer is no, we are not, unfortunately.
Okay. Thanks for that candor. I know you represent Broward Health, but I just want to read a portion of a statement from your system partner, Memorial Healthcare. And I should mention you both have the same CEO, Shane Strum. Memorial said, quote, "Florida Blue's reimbursement proposals do not equitably reflect the cost of providing high quality, complex care, which could impact our ability to continue to invest in our community," end quote. Is that also Broward Health's stance vis-a-vis Florida Blue, Dr. Boyar? And if so, can you elaborate on it, please?
Yeah, I could speak about Broward Health's current stance and position on this, really, is, we are currently out of network with Florida Blue.
Right.
And just of a note, you know, we're two separate entities.
Yes.
That we're talking about here. So right now there is certainly a delta in what we as far as coming to the table goes. And there's really years of being chronically, underpaid.
Right.
And essentially, in order to get kind of a fair level for reimbursement, we're just asking for that rates be a fair market value, or rates that we might get from other insurance companies for the same services. Mm-hmm. And right now, the reimbursement is substantially below those that we receive from other insurance companies. Mm-hmm. And kind of refuse to recognize the value of our life-saving care and our nurses and our doctors that provide for their members. Mm-hmm. At current.
How big a factor here is the fact that Memorial and Broward Health are both public, not-for-profit, taxpayer-funded healthcare systems, meaning you don't have the largesse or financial latitude that, say, a for-profit hospital system would have? Is that one of your central arguments in this negotiation for higher insurance reimbursements?
No, not at all.
Okay.
As far as I'm concerned, we're currently at a network with Florida Blue because we strictly want to be at fair market value.
Uh-huh.
And as a matter of fact, the our strong desire, we actually want to stay in network, right?
Right.
And we've had multiple discussions and haven't come to the table, and we actually even proposed hiring an independent and qualified third party to determine the respective F&B reimbursement, and both parties would then agree and accept it. But Florida Blue outright rejected this, and even coupled it with potentially going on a glide path.
Okay.
And to answer your question, as far as Florida Blue goes, as far as maybe premiums going up for patients, I mean their rates are going up regardless, regardless of what our contract negotiations are.
Okay.
And the irony is, to be honest with you, it'll actually shift their patients to other hospitals that actually have higher rates.
Okay.
Now,
in response, Florida Blue issued a statement on its part that said, in part, quote, "We are disappointed that Memorial and Broward Health see cutting off in-network access to two major healthcare providers as what is best for the community," end quote. Why did Broward Health and Memorial Healthcare, and I realize you're only speaking for Broward Health here, decide that decoupling almost 50,000 Broward County patients was the best or only course of action to take at this point? Was there any talk of extending Florida Blue patients' access to in-network care after the expiration dates while the negotiations continue?
So just to be clear, so these are two separate negotiations.
Exactly. Exactly.
And anyone knowledgeable in the healthcare industry knows that, managed care negotiations are between that individual health system, CFOs, and their managed care teams.
Mm-hmm.
So from Broward Health, our CFOs, our managed care teams are working directly with Blue Cross Blue Shield. I can only speak of, our negotiations with Florida Blue, but mm-hmm. we do feel that Florida Blue's decision to force two community-based safety net health systems within the same county to go out of the network at the same time very much characterizes their integrity of Florida Blue and the value they place on patients and who needs care.
Okay.
But moreover, one more thing.
Uh-huh.
As more go out of network, it kind of shows profit over patient.
Okay. As I said, we'll be hearing from the president of here in South Florida, Florida Blue, in just a second. There are, however, Dr. Boyar, exceptions to this in-network freeze-out, as it were, right? Cancer patients, for example, who fall under continuation of care laws, for example, and emergency care, correct? Can you remind us which other patients can still access in-network care amidst this dispute?
Yeah, so great question. The there is a continuity of care, which, by the way, has an expiration date. And there's also under EMTALA that emergency services are provided. However, if you think about it, even under continuity of care, if you think about anybody who's being treated for a disease process, right, even an oncologist, a cancer patient, right, uh-huh. they're going to get complications or side effects around their treatment. And they might have a team of heart doctors, kidney doctors, lung doctors, all being coordinated by their primary care doctor to give this patient or community all the care that they need.
Right.
And then out of network, all these subspecialists go, and so does the primary care doctor. So now they're all of a sudden just left in the midst of their treatment and their illness where they have to go totally elsewhere to be able to get their care and as far as the medical records, so on and so forth.
Okay. In just the minute we have left here, Dr. Boyar, I also wanted to ask you about the larger picture involved here, meaning what does the U.S., not just Broward County, but America, need to do to fix this chronic impasse we're facing more and more between healthcare providers and healthcare insurers? I mean, both sides seem to have valid economic arguments here, but it's the whole American healthcare framework in which these disputes are occurring that seems to be most out of whack. No? What's the solution?
I mean, at the end of the day, I'm a doctor.
Sure.
And we're going to go just back to the basics. You live in the community. I'm a father. I'm a husband. I'm an ER doctor. I work in our system. Mm-hmm. You know, our patients, our community, they're the main focus. And, you know, our healthcare system, all we want is to be able to come back to the table, fair market value, so
okay.
then we can continue to provide the high quality of care
okay.
that we do. And that's probably the sentiment nationwide also
okay.
between the two entities.
We'll have to leave it there for time. Dr. Evan Boyar is Chief Medical Officer for Broward Health. Dr. Boyar, many thanks. We also have on the line with us now Dora, a longtime Florida Blue medical insurance policy holder. She's calling from Fort Lauderdale. Dora, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Hi there.
What's your concern?
So, and just a quick correction, it's Dara with an A, not an O.
Okay, sorry.
So I'm a longtime Florida Blue patient. My family practitioner, who is amazing and has coordinated everything through my care, has helped me so much. And it's really scary to suddenly be without access to 80% of my doctors. I have some of my ongoing oncology care through Sylvester, through the University of Miami, and some other doctors. But all of my care, all of my surgery, I was diagnosed with breast cancer at the end of 2021, had double mastectomy in 2022, mm-hmm. finished what they call active treatment at the end of that year. But I'm someone who was left with secondary lymphedema in both arms and hands. I have lots of other issues. I developed autoimmune issues during treatment. So even though I am no longer in quote unquote active care and would not be covered under continuity of care, I have a ton of needs. My doctors from Memorial do a great job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Memorial Regional is the ER. So like
right.
the last time I was just there when I caught mm-hmm. COVID for the first time, and ended up needing to go to the ER. I had an allergic reaction to a medication I was given. They were wonderful, and it
yeah.
was quick, it was easy, they're professional, and to suddenly lose access, but also I work in downtown Fort Lauderdale, and
yeah.
to know, so the old Broward General, it's Broward Health, that's over off of 3rd and 17th Street Causeway,
right.
to know that all of these close hospitals to where I live
yes.
and where I work are suddenly not within network is outrageous in a county of 2
right.
million people.
Well, Dora, many thanks for your call, and we're sorry you're having to deal with these, and I hope this all gets resolved for you and so many other patients soon. Thank you very much again for sharing your experience with us. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I just spoke with Dr. Evan Boyar about the troubling rift involving Broward County's two major healthcare systems, Broward Health and Memorial Healthcare, and health insurer Florida Blue, which has left tens of thousands of Broward patients, like Dora, who just called, stranded with no in-network care. I want to turn now to David Wagner. He's the South Florida Market President for Florida Blue. Mr. Wagner, thanks for coming on.
Tim, thanks for having me. Good afternoon.
We also want to hear from our listeners, as we said. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Mr. Wagner, I know you want to respond to some of the points Dr. Boyar made earlier, but I first want to ask you the same opening question. From where you sit, do you see any progress at the moment in the negotiations between Memorial and Broward Health and Florida Blue that could get these almost 50,000 policyholders of yours back in-network care in Broward County?
Tim, we want nothing more than a deal with Memorial and Broward Health. First and foremost, looking out for our community, just like what Dara just explained, there's well over 50,000 folks affected here in Broward County. And this 9 hospital, you know, 6 at Memorial and 3 at Broward Health, they chose to go out of network July 1st and September 1st, is a major concern.
Right. But to my question, though, are we any closer? Can you just give us a quick update?
We've gotten a little closer with Memorial. There is a gap with Broward Health, if I'm being transparent. So, and okay. We're at the table and we are talking and we are communicating in other ways as well.
Now, concerning the core negotiation issue here, in a nutshell, Memorial Healthcare and Broward Health are demanding higher insurance reimbursements from Florida Blue, while Florida Blue argues that that could put health insurance premiums out of reach for too many Broward County residents. You stated last week that canceling in-network care for Florida Blue policyholders is, quote, disappointing. What is your biggest criticism of that move they took on the part of Memorial and Broward Health?
Tim, your term of higher reimbursement that they're asking for is a massive understatement. They're asking for a 60% increase contract over contract, $150 million. A normal annual increase could be 1, 2, 3%, 4%. They're asking for 60%. And as Dr. Boyer said, wanting fair market values all at once. Well, let me remind everybody that the past rates that we agreed to were offered by Broward Health and we accepted them. So those were the rates they asked for, and we accepted them.
Okay.
And so we have to really be good stewards for our community, because where does that cost get passed on to the community member, to the cardholder? We just can't do that. We're asking for fair and reasonable negotiations.
In the meantime, what are you telling your policyholders at this moment about their options? You heard Dr. Boyer discuss the exceptions to this in-network freeze-out, cancer and pregnancy patients, for example. But what about the rest?
Listen, there are a lot of options. First of all of our members can go to the closest ER. So to Dara's point, if she's working in Fort Lauderdale and she needs to go to Broward Health, go to the ER if she needs it. If she gets admitted or our members get admitted through their ERs, we're happy to do single case agreements and work on a case-by-case basis. We have folks at the ready to work with our individual policyholders.
Okay.
They can always look on the back of their membership card and call that number. And we are here to really support them. We are more than generous when it comes to continuity of care and expectations. And let me remind you, Tim, and the listeners, we've been in Florida for 80 years. We're not on the stock exchange. We're not selling stocks. We're very community focused, giving well over $25 million back to the community. And what we're doing in the zip codes in Broward County, like 3311 in Sistrunk, and what we're doing in Fort Lauderdale for mother babies and far beyond coverage, we are committed to this community.
Let me get to that.
Look out for the best interests of our community.
Let me get to that community point you're making. Florida Blue, unlike a private insurer like United Health, for example, is a not-for-profit company. How big a factor is that reality in your negotiating argument that you can't meet the insurance reimbursement demands that Memorial and Broward Health are making of you without making your premiums unaffordable? What are the financial constraints that you're claiming in these negotiations?
First of all, what I said, a 60% increase contract is just something you don't see. It's, you might as well ask for $5 trillion. I mean, it's just not something you see every day. And they're wanting to make up, or what they see make up for years of rates that they gave to us and we agreed to. So we're asking them to be fair and reasonable. We appreciate the doctors and the nurses and the therapists. All three of my kids were born at Memorial. Sure. I'm a clinician. I did clinicals through Broward Health. I understand. We love the nurses. We love the doctors. Even the folks we're negotiating with, they're local, I am in Broward. So we want to work this out and come to an agreement.
But in its statement this week, for example, Memorial Healthcare argued that Florida Blue has been raising premiums for its policyholders and that, therefore, you should be able to meet the higher reimbursement requests they're making. What's your response to that?
My response, Tim, is to give you some numbers. In 2002, the cost for an insulin vial was $35. Today, it's $274 for a 10 milligram vial of insulin. Mm-hmm. A round of chemo in 2002 was $1,500. Today, it's well over $10,000. We have to curb the cost. And these costs are passed on to our community members. Mm-hmm. So we want to work in partnership with Memorial and Broward Health. We truly do. We love what they do in the community. We have decades-long history of working for Broward County together. We want nothing more to continue to do that. And out of nowhere, these demands have just been not what we're used to, Tim,
Now
and
th-
not something we can pass on to the community.
Now, this week we read one benefits consultant in the South Florida Sun Sentinel, for example, making the point that a lot of Broward County employers right now are looking at these negotiations and they're thinking, you know, my employees prefer to stick with Memorial and Broward Health, so maybe it's time to find a new healthcare insurer besides Florida Blue so I can get them back in network. Do you worry that means that perhaps Florida Blue has less negotiating leverage than the healthcare providers you're up against in this dispute?
Tim, that's a great question. But who's to say whoever they switch to isn't next up to negotiate with Memorial and Broward, who now have this leverage of 9 hospitals in one county with one CEO and one COO, 9 hospitals in Broward County. Who's to say the person they switch to isn't asked for $150 million or go pound sand? So yeah, that can't happen.
Okay. Now, finally, in the last 30 seconds we have here, Mr. Wagner, I want to put that larger question that I asked Dr. Boyar to you as well. What is the general healthcare industry dysfunction at play here, not just in Broward County, but nationally, and not just on the healthcare provider side or the health insurer side, that's got to get fixed so we don't keep running into crises like these?
It is definitely the cost and staying and trying to stay with the inflation, Tim, and definitely looking at going to value contracting and looking at value where we look at outcomes for members and not for this fee for service and X amount for a service. So we have to get in putting the patient and the member first and sharing in those wins.
David Wagner is the South Florida Market President for Health Insurer Florida Blue. Mr. Wagner, many thanks. Still to come, trouble in the Conch Republic. Is Key West City Hall a hostile place? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. We've seen a political crisis brewing in Key West stemming from its development crisis for a long time now. Simply put, there is too little land to build on in the so-called Conch Republic and too many people competing for it. That's produced a catch-22 of sorts. Key West has a severe affordable housing shortage, for example, but necessary growth management regulations, especially related to hurricane safety, make it harder to alleviate that shortage. So do sea level rise and outsized demand for rental housing for rich tourists. This year, the stress has taken its toll on Key West City Hall. In April, a grand jury indicted the chief building officer for allegedly falsifying permit records. The FBI is investigating other practices. And this week, planning director Katie Halloran resigned while issuing a blistering letter that accuses the city government there of creating a hostile work environment for anyone trying to manage Key West's fraught land development. So how does Margaritaville solve these problems before paradise is lost? Joining me now to discuss that is Mandy Miles. She's a veteran reporter for Keys Weekly in Key West. Mandy, how are you?
I'm great, Tim. Thanks for having me.
No, are any of you out there listening a conk? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So Mandy, I'm sure you've read by now now former Key West Planning Director Katie Halloran's resignation letter this week. What struck you most about the allegations she makes about Key West city government, and just as important, its relationship with Key West developers, and how all of this is affecting the critical growth management effort there?
I think, yes, of course, I read Katie Halloran's letter, and I was not entirely surprised. I've known Katie Halloran and her work for the 5 years that she's done it. I've also obviously been covering the turmoil in City Hall that's been going on, coming up on 2 years now. I think the first thing I always sort of look back on is that the position of planning director in the city of Key West is a thankless, thankless job. Uh-huh. There are so many competing factions here when it comes to the job description is to interpret and apply our land development regulations, which, right, as you said, we have very limited land, no place to build, hurricane evacuation requirements, ROGO and building permit limitations. So it's difficult to develop here. And her job is to, you know, sort of recommend to our volunteer appointed planning board why certain projects do or do not comply with our development regulations. So mm-hmm. that automatically makes her unpopular with most of the right. town's powerful right. developers. It's a no-win situation.
Right. Yeah, well, I'm glad you pointed out that it's a thankless job there. As I mentioned earlier, Halloran's resignation is just the latest flashpoint in an ongoing scandal there in Key West involving this issue of building and development and growth management. Chief Building Officer Rajinder Ram Singh was indicted earlier this year by a grand jury. Others were arrested as well. The FBI is investigating what's going on there. Can you bring us up to speed, Mandy, on what's happened so far in this Conk drama and how we got here? I know, for example, something called the Corradino Report plays a central role, no?
Yes, absolutely. So this all started, and Katie Halloran was in the thick of it back in April, June of 2024, a year ago. There were warring factions between the planning department and the building department. Our building official, Raj Ram Singh, who is the brother of our former city attorney, which was created a rather incestuous relationship.
I can imagine.
Yes. So it turned out there were suspicions on Katie Halloran's part that Raj Ram Singh was approving building permits, development applications, and projects, construction projects, without her department in planning having seen them, without having, you know, they hadn't been evaluated for compliance with our development regulations,
right,
which is not how things are supposed to work. Mm-hmm. Katie Halloran made her concerns known to the then city manager, who commissioned a third-party study of what was happening between the planning and building departments. And that is that 55-page report was the Corradino report that did, right, in a way, validate a lot of Katie Halloran's and the planning department's concerns about right. things that were going on in the building department.
Can you all also help us understand how this larger development crisis came about for Key West? I mentioned earlier, too much demand for too little land, and a lot of that has to do with Key West just being Margaritaville, a remarkably popular quote-unquote paradise spot to live and visit. But when you look at things like the so-called rate of growth ordinance, or ROGO, as you mentioned earlier, that Key West has to abide by these days, not to mention the hurricane and climate change mitigation practices that have to be followed there, it seems a lot more complicated than that, no?
Very complicated. Absolutely very complicated. We have no empty lots to build on in Key West. We have height restrictions, so it's very difficult to add a second or third floor to a building unless it's going to be for an affordable housing project, which is the priority in the city. So there are so many rules, but there's also the value of our land and the value of existing properties or, you know, rental permits, if you have the right to rent a property down here, that makes it very, very valuable. So people will do a lot to try and find any loophole
right.
to make sure they can get their renovation project, their new development project approved.
And that brings us obviously to one of the most important problems all this has spawned, which is the severe affordable housing shortage down there. Just how severe are we talking about right now, Mandy?
Oh, Tim, I've lived here for 27 years now, and I have not seen, people have been wringing their hands about this issue since I got here in 1998, but it has been, I would say, reached fever pitch since probably right before and certainly during COVID,
right.
when a lot of the issue is there used to be so many big old wooden houses that would have four or five apartments in them, and each of them would hold, you know, a working couple in town. So there'd be 10 working people in a big old house. Those houses in the past decade have been bought, flipped, gutted, and are now luxury, often vacation rentals, whether they're allowed to be weekly rentals or month-long vacation rentals. So all of a sudden, you've taken a ton of multifamily units, and no longer are there any long-term annual rentals for working people.
Right.
With the, you know, median cost of a house down here, about close to $1 million, nobody's going to be owning homes, the working class.
Nope, that's a great point. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Keys Weekly reporter Mandy Miles about the growing political crisis in Key West that's growing out of its development crisis, a problem so many South Florida communities can relate to, frankly. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Mandy, amid all this, what is the major source of friction down there that's causing all this dysfunction in City Hall? I go back to one of Planning Director Katie Halloran's core complaints in her resignation letter, which is that government government leaders like City Manager Brian Barroso have allegedly been suppressing efforts to regulate growth in Key West, to pull back on development review practices, for example, while favoring builders and developers. Has Mr. Barroso replied to those accusations?
He has not, and I don't think that's a fair characterization.
Okay, that's what I also wanted to ask you if that was fair as well, yeah.
Just to be clear, you know, Brian Barroso has his own leadership style, very different from his predecessor, but he inherited the corruption indictments and what I called Key West Corruptate whenever I whenever I updated my stories. He inherited that from his predecessor and the former city manager, who actually is the one that commissioned the Corradino report and a lot of people say was fired because he was sort of trying to shed a light on these building department practices.
Right.
So no, Brian Barroso, he is absolutely without question changing things. Mm-hmm. So, and I believe, at least from my observance, and I can't blame Katie Halloran for when she felt she was absolutely vindicated and validated by her concerns, by the Corradino report. They were followed up by state attorney investigations and FBI investigations, indictments and arrests, really predicated on what she had complained about with the building department.
Right.
So it seemed, I think it seems like from my observation that she absolutely, her complaints were validated. But then when there was a new city manager in, I think the way he's going about trying to fix things would not have been the way she would have wanted or anticipated.
Okay.
And there's obviously differences in personality.
Well, that's why we wanted to bring you on, to get a more balanced assessment of the sort of accusations that were in her letter. So we really appreciate you bringing that fair assessment. I, of course, also want to ask you, Mandy, what you see ahead or what's already happening in terms of Key West efforts and the efforts of Key West residents and civic groups to start fixing these development crisis problems. Are Key West locals or conks feeling fairly fed up at this point? And if so, what are they doing about it?
Yes. They are fed up, but it's also a combination of being fed up, fighting it, and then also a sort of a resignation to it, saying, all right, well, here's the rich guy. He applies to build a bunch of new vacation rentals. And, you know, who are we? They're just going to approve it. And here we go. He's got a ton of money. And that's just the way it goes. And there is sort of a sense of resignation among people that, you know, money and power can make things happen in this town. But there also is a sense, the recent indictments and arrests and investigation did give people a sense, because it came out that a grand jury report said that the rules can't just apply to those with influence. They have to be applied evenly. And there is more oversight and scrutiny with people paying attention and more people willing to expose it, whether they call the media, you, myself, if they, you know, post something on Facebook, file a complaint, call the state attorney's office. So there is absolutely more light being shed on it. The problem is just really a political will when it comes to saying no to certain developers, saying, listen, if you want to build this project, you have to include a certain amount of affordable housing for workers.
Yeah.
And there's no money in affordable housing. So they're going to do everything they can to minimize that obligation.
Tough balance. Finally, Mandy, whenever we talk about problems like these in the Keys, and especially Key West, we worry about whether we're on the cusp of losing South Florida's trademark paradise. Will paradise survive all of this?
Key West always survives. Key West is resilient, if not, I mean, they are fiercely independent, resilient. They're always the problem child, obviously, for Tallahassee. But Key West will Key West will absolutely survive and thrive. We have our own little, sibling infighting and everything. But absolutely, we're still a beautiful place to live, and I can't imagine being anywhere else.
Mandy Miles is a reporter for Keys Weekly in Key West. Mandy, many thanks. Still to come, Trump sends the military to fight Venezuela's drug cartels. Will it also invade Venezuela? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. On Tuesday, President Trump told us that the U.S. military assets he's called into the Southern Caribbean for counter-narcotics operations had destroyed a boat coming out of Venezuela that was filled with drugs and headed for America. He said the strike killed 11 members of the Venezuelan gang known as Tren de Aragua, who were on board. It was a rare and, say legal experts, a seriously questionable way to conduct drug interdiction. But Trump says this is the more effective way to stop Latin America's drug cartels. Another issue, though, is whether all this U.S. military might Trump has marshaled off of Venezuela, several warships and thousands of Marines, is ultimately meant to take down Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro's brutal drug trafficking regime, which is exactly what so many Venezuelan exiles here in South Florida want Trump to do. I spoke yesterday with Miami Herald reporter Antonio Maria Delgado about this unusual operation, what it might portend, and what those Venezuelan exiles hope it portends. Antonio, always great to have you on.
It's my pleasure.
In all the long years that you and I have covered Latin America, we've often watched the U.S. Coast Guard pull over drug boats in the Caribbean, seize their cargo, and arrest their traffickers. But I can't ever remember a deadly U.S. military strike on a drug boat like this. Can you, Antonio?
Not at all. I think this is the first time, actually, that I see something like this. Like you said, usually they capture the boat, arrest the people, take the drugs, and then present them in a nice photo op.
Yeah, right. With all the big bundles of drugs and everything. Right. Yeah. But you had mentioned earlier, Antonio, when we were talking, that there are some reports coming out of Venezuela now that perhaps help to confirm what President Trump was saying this week, that this actually was a drug boat and that these were Tren de Aragua gang members on that boat.
Yes. And I have not been able to confirm this independently, but there are some news sites out of Venezuela basically saying that the boat came out of coast in Sucre State.
Which is on the eastern part of the Venezuelan coast, right?
Yeah, close to Trinidad and Tobago.
Uh-huh.
And that area, it's not only allegedly controlled by the Venezuelan cartel, but also that it's an important hub from where the drugs are cheap to sea,
right,
in fast boats. So there's some indications that this could have been boat carrying drugs. That being said, there hasn't been any proof or evidence presented so far.
Right. And what sort of drugs would be coming out of that area, Antonio? Would it be cocaine? Because there'd been some mention of fentanyl, but I'm not familiar with fentanyl coming through that part of the Caribbean.
It would be cocaine.
Yeah.
Venezuela has become an important transportation corridor for the cocaine coming out of eastern Colombia. And the indications point to the belief the volume of drugs coming out of Venezuela have increased in the past 5 years. The last estimate pointed to 500 tons per year.
Wow.
This out of 250 a few years back.
President Trump has designated drug cartels not only in Venezuela, but in Mexico and elsewhere in Latin America as international terrorists. And it would appear, he claims, that then gives him the legal authority to use deadly military force against cartel traffickers, as we would to take out a terrorist like Osama bin Laden, for example, instead of the kind of police tactics we usually see the Coast Guard use. But what are legal experts saying about that?
There has been a great deal of criticism on this. First of all, it's a war crime to destroy a civilian vessel unless there's some kind of threat going on. And the fact that the administration has so far not provided any evidence that there were drugs in the boat. But even with that, it's questionable whether the way to deal with this is to send a missile to the boat instead of capturing them.
Yeah.
There were some interesting comments Secretary of State Marco Rubio gave when he was in Mexico a couple of days ago, where he said that Trump was asked what to do with the boat, and instead of intercepting it, he gave orders to blow it up. That makes me think there was a chance, there was a possibility, this guy's being apprehended instead of being killed.
Yeah, I've seen the same thing, that there could have been some violation of international law. But President Trump also claims that military force is justified because the Venezuelan regime, including dictator President Nicolas Maduro, who's been indicted in the U.S. on drug trafficking charges and has a $50 million bounty now on his head here, is itself a narco cartel, and that Venezuelan gangs like Tren de Aragua are its narco associates. Remind our listeners, Antonio, what this alleged Cartel de los Soles, or Cartel of the Suns, as it's called, is inside Venezuela that Trump is obviously targeting.
Yes, the United States have been investigating the cartel for quite a bit of time now. And there has been some indications that it began in the early 2000s by late President Chavez. who gathered some of his top lieutenants and basically told them, look, we're going to go out there and partner up with the leftist Colombian guerrillas, the FARC, and we're going to get into the drug business with them. The idea being that they would obtain the military weapons from Venezuela in exchange of being paid with drugs or partnering it up or being somehow getting involved in the drug trade.
Yeah, and we should point out the Venezuelan military plays a very large role in this cartel de los Soles.
Yes, it is basically run by the military and now allegedly headed by Nicolas Maduro, who was in the beginning an inner member of this organization. After he became head of state, basically his role in the organization grew. And then some of this testimony that the U.S. has gathered from some of these top lieutenants who have been arrested or have defected and became key witnesses here in the U.S. points to this organization being created by Chavez with the purpose, according to this, their testimony, and it's not only one, there's several, with the aim of hurting the U.S. with the drug trade. Basically, Chavez declared the U.S. an enemy of Venezuela. And he felt that it was necessary to have this underhanded way of hurting the U.S.
Yeah.
And that was through drugs. But at the same time, the aim was to help the FARC topple the Colombian government.
Right. And so that's the basis of President Trump's claim that Venezuela is, quote, invading the U.S. in that particular way. And so remind us, Antonio, also just how much U.S. naval and other firepower then Trump has sent into the Southern Caribbean near Venezuela to confront this cartel and what it's supposed to be there for.
Well, I mean, it's a quite a large, you know, naval force in the Southern Caribbean. We're talking about 8 different warships.
Mm-hmm.
3 of them are late Burke class destroyers, and these are the ones that have the Tomahawk missiles. There are 3 different amphibious operations vessels, including the San Antonio, the Iwo Jima, and the Fort Lauderdale. Iwo Jima, I believe, it's like a small airplane carrier that is designed to be able to take Marines, you know, go to the coast and for enemy coasts. And there also include 4,500 men. We're talking about maybe probably 2,000 Marines.
Marines, right, yeah. Some of these warships are guided missile cruisers, which could help explain how that drug boat was struck this week, no?
Yes, they have the Tomahawk missiles, which is quite devastating. This is obviously causing a lot of nervousness inside Venezuela.
Sure.
And we've seen Maduro several proclamations. One of them was to activate the militias.
Yeah.
Even though the militias are in no shape able to face the, you know, the U.S. military.
Yeah.
But also they announced recently they're going to activate drones to be able to be on guard on the coast. And some of these drones, they can launch bombs, they can launch small missiles.
Right.
They're developed by Iran, and there's a partnership between the two countries.
You did some great reporting on that recently. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with the Miami Herald's Antonio Maria Delgado about this week's U.S. military strike on a suspected drug boat out of Venezuela and what it might or might not portend. Antonio, I want to turn to the bigger question that's arisen this week, and that's whether all of this could be leading to a more serious U.S. military strike at the Maduro regime in Venezuela itself. A lot of military experts are questioning why Trump has that much military muscle pointed at Venezuela just for counter-narcotics. That many military assets have to be poised for something larger. And now I realize it's just speculation at this point, but if that's the case, what might some of those larger objectives be? It seems unlikely, but is a full-scale invasion of Venezuela a possibility?
No, with this size military, you would need, we're talking about an operation similar to what we saw in the Middle East, in Iraq, for example. Probably in Venezuela, you would need the equivalent of 40,000 or 50,000 men.
So about 10 times more than what's there right now, yeah.
Yes, mostly to be able to secure. I mean, you could probably defeat the Venezuelan military quite easily. But after that, I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah, that being said, you know, this size force, it's much bigger than what you would need just to fight drug trafficking. One of the possibilities would be some kind of extraction. You know, we saw these huge rewards for the capture of Maduro and the capture of his number 2 lieutenant, Yuval Cabello, who might be the real head or the controlling force behind the cartel. And the U.S. is offering $25 million for him. But it also might be seeking to generate some kind of psychological effect within the Venezuelan military. It kind of makes it feel that Maduro, your days are about to end. So we might as well intervene, act, or topple him so we can get a favorable terms with the U.S. afterwards.
All right. No, that obviously makes a lot of sense. We can't ignore the fact, though, that a U.S. invasion of Venezuela is what many Venezuelan expats here have been hoping for, if not expecting, from Trump for many years now. And a lot of them are unhappy with him right now for his campaign to strip Venezuelan migrants of their temporary protected status and humanitarian parole and deport them back to Venezuela and the dictatorship and the humanitarian crisis there. Is Trump going to have to keep raising the ante against Venezuela this way to keep those expats here happy, a lot of whom vote? What is the Venezuelan diaspora here saying on social media, for example?
This situation has created a great deal of expectations. There were people even joking that they might be able to go back to Venezuela in December for Christmas and eat the hallacas, which is the Venezuelan
Christmas food, right? Yeah.
There has been some expectation, but Venezuelans have gone through these kind of things before. There has been moments where they're very hopeful. In the last 2 decades, they've endured what has been very damaging regime that has basically destroyed the economy and it caused more than 6 or 7 million Venezuelans to leave their countries on difficult situations.
About a quarter of the population, yeah. But along those lines, Antonio, I mean, this week, the Trump administration also canceled temporary protected status or protection against deportation, as I mentioned, for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan migrants here. Does it seem, though, like cognitive dissonance to one day say things are so bad in Venezuela that we need to conduct military strikes against their drug cartels, and yet the next day say conditions have improved enough in Venezuela that it's okay now to send Venezuelan migrants back to the country?
Yeah, there's a contradiction in there. Also, we've seen the State Department issue advisories for Americans not to travel to Venezuela.
Right.
The first time they announced they were going to do away with the TPS, the 2023, the one issued during Biden.
Right.
The declaration was that the situation in Venezuela has improved significantly or sufficiently for Venezuelans to return. And honestly, that is not the case. Venezuela continues to be a very dangerous place. There's a lot of crime, but not only that, the state persecution is so dangerous that they can take you and torture you and put you in a horrible jail, as it has happened with more than 2,000 Venezuelans after
after Maduro stole the presidential election last summer. Yeah,
that's right. And also, you know, the economy is in shambles. It's really hard to get basic services. The conditions that push these 7 million people to leave Venezuela, they're still in the country. They're still alone.
But finally, Antonio, let's say for the sake of argument that Trump eventually does stage some sort of invasion or operation against Maduro or his regime. And let's say we bring the regime down. Would the U.S. be walking into a sort of Iraq-style quagmire in Venezuela, given what we've just been talking about?
There's a chance that might very well happen. I would say that 90 to 95% of the population do want to change in Venezuela.
Sure.
You have a whole bunch of armed groups operating. You have the ELN, which is the other side, the other
branch. These are former left-wing Colombian guerrillas who have leached into Venezuela in recent years and are operating there now. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're controlled by sectors. And these guys, they do know how to fight. They had a situation where the Venezuelan military had to confront the dissident group of the FARC, and this dissident group won, beat them, they were killed. And they had to call the help of the ELN. And it was the ELN who are, you know, they have people who've been fighting since they were 14.
Yeah.
And they're extra fighters.
And these guys are loyal to the Maduro regime since they've come in. And you've also got paramilitary street enforcers like the Colectivos and groups like that that would also be loyal to the regime and would put up a fight, I would imagine, no?
Yes. If there's a change in Venezuela, whoever leads it, it's one of the priorities going to have to kind of take care of these groups.
Yeah.
Plus, some of them are controlled by regime members. So, it's not going to be an easy transition.
No, it would be a bit of a hot mess. Antonio Maria Delgado covers Venezuela and Latin America for our news partner, the Miami Herald. Antonio, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Yesterday, two Venezuelan fighter jets flew over one of those U.S. Navy warships. Finally on the roundup, you will remember 2 weeks ago, a federal judge here in Miami ordered the shutdown of the controversial migrant detention center out in the Everglades known as Alligator Alcatraz. Yesterday, a federal appeals court put a hold on that order, and so for now, Alligator Alcatraz will continue to operate in spite of the intense human rights and environmental scrutiny it's come under since it was hastily erected in July. The appellate judges did not buy the argument that because Florida will supposedly receive federal reimbursement for Alligator Alcatraz's cost, it is therefore a federal and not a state facility and should have undergone federal environmental review before it went online, which it did not. The appellate judges said that since no federal money has yet been provided, Alligator Alcatraz can't be called a federal detention center. The question, of course, becomes, if and when the federal funds do materialize, can Alligator Alcatraz then be called a federal facility? The case continues, but for the moment, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is the one crowing.
Alligator Alcatraz is, in fact, like we've always said, open for business, and we're going to continue leading the way when it comes to immigration enforcement.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.